You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful Davis December. But you know, Don, it's spring is coming. The solstice is over and the days are starting to
get longer. And we've had our chilling hours already. So it is December 24th as Lois and I are preparing this show for broadcast on December 25th. For your listening pleasure, you all might have a day off, perhaps. It is 56 degrees, partly cloudy here in Dixon as we prepare this for broadcast. I did see the sun about 15 minutes ago. It was very pretty. We appear to be in the only place in the state of California that's not under major active weather hazard alerts. We've got a flood watch, yeah, and a high wind warning, yeah. Neither of those things really seem to be happening here, but many parts of the state of California are going to have what they often call active weather over the next couple to few days, including some serious, serious rainfall totals in Southern California. Looking at the LA Basin and particularly the hills behind LA, it's going to be a lot of rain, flooding. It's going to be pretty much a whole long day of disasters. So best wishes to all of you down there as this will be unfolding as this broadcasts. Many of you probably saw the video footage of flooding in Redding, way north, northern Sacramento Valley, flooding over near Eureka, well, actually Humboldt County. We had a lot of rain in the northwest part of the state and into the north part of the Sacramento Valley. What's happening in a nutshell is we have two atmospheric rivers aiming at us being the whole state. And I saw a really interesting graphic that showed the two arrows pointing towards more or less central to Northern California, with one of them veering north, the other one veering south. That one is very warm and very wet. But the main thing is the part in the middle that wasn't going to get either of them is Sacramento. Once again, these are going to go around us and there's going to be a lot of rainfall. It's going to start out as rain up at the high elevations, which is unfortunate since there is basically almost no snowpack up there at this point. As Daniel Swain says at Weather West, the last 3 to 4 weeks sure have been exceptionally warm across most of the western United States. Record warmth occurred literally every day across a substantial chunk of the western third of the country, and December 2025 is likely to end up as the warmest on record across a wide region, with snowpack in most basins at record or near record lows. However, here for the first 2 weeks of December, we didn't get above 45 degrees. So we were in valley fog, which finally cleared out thanks to these storms. This first storm coming into the Sierra is going to be wet, and then the next one is going to be cold and actually going to drop a pretty significant amount of snow. If you aren't familiar with the California Nevada River Forecast Site, California Nevada River Forecast Center, CNRFC. It's an extraordinary resource, and they have a great graphic image there where you can go in right now and look at forecast precipitation for any part of the state. You can take your cursor and run it up and down and see that, oh, look at that. Los Angeles right behind is going to have, holy mackerel, 10 inches of rain in the next 72 hours. So you can figure out exactly where you are, zoom in a little closer, and you can also see, clicking above that, how much we've had. And Davis, in the last 72 hours, has recorded less than an inch of rain. Vacaville has recorded 1.5 to 2 inches of rain. And for those of you outside the area, Vacaville is only about 25 miles west of Davis. So we're getting our typical pattern of the storms coming in, hitting the coast range, orographic effect, causing rapid uplift of the clouds and squeezing moisture out of them over the coast range in wine country, down on into Vacaville, stopping, getting the rain shadow effect, Davis, Sacramento getting about half as much rain as the western part of the Coast Range by comparison. So we're going to see steady, warm rain for a couple of days, and then it's going to get a lot colder. And what matters about the a lot colder part is that on Sunday, it's going to be about 36 degrees at night. First time we've gotten that cold in a few weeks. And it's going to clear up Sunday night after having only been 48 degrees on Sunday. Much colder storm coming in behind what we're experiencing right now. Clears up 36 degrees, Monday night 37 degrees. When I see those numbers, I realize there's a possibility of frost on a night like that, simply from more of the clouds clearing, more of the heat being lost to the sky, possibility of frost. So if you've been sort of casually not worrying about your subtropical plants, in the next few days, you might want to move them a little closer in. More to the point, head on over to weatherwest.com if you want all the details. For you as a gardener, you want to make sure you don't have containers filling up with water because they don't drain. That's the first thing, something that happens to almost all of us at one point or another in our gardening career. Ooh, that hole got plugged. Now I have a bog. The other is if water stands around trees, if you're in an area where flooding actually does occur and water stands around trees, when it's very cold, I'm not concerned about that because it's cold enough that the pathogens that would normally be harmful to the trees are simply not active. But we're quite warm. We're very unseasonally warm right now. So if water is standing, pooling around a tree or a shrub, particularly the kind where we say needs good drainage, drain that water off somehow. It can be as simple as getting out there and digging a little channel to drain the water to some other part of the yard. It's fine on the lawn, fine in the landscape border, but not great for woody plants when we have water standing around them and it's warm. That's our weather advice for the day. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. That means we rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you're one of those people that likes to give year-end donations, well, it's the end of the year. So head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. We'd love to be on your year-end donation list. And thanks for listening. We'll have an announcement actually about the Rocky Outcrops show. He's got a special program coming up in January. If you're a bluegrass fan, he's got a special guest coming into the studio January 9. Rocky knows some really cool people in the world of bluegrass. We'll give you more information next week about the special programming in January 9th. On Rocky Outcrop's show. Oh, that's the show.
It's special time and it's twice as long as usual. So tune in next week. We'll tell you all about it. In the meantime, Don, there are so many things happening in the world, and 2026 is just right around the corner. So we have gotten our announcement from the Fair Oaks Horticultural Center, and they have lots of programs, free programs that people can go to. It says now that they've got their 2026 schedule out, and January 1st, 9 a.m. to noon is the first of their programs for the year. And this is going to be talking, they have several little mini talks, so you can hear lots of different things. One is selecting and maintaining succulents. Another is starting seeds for the summer vegetable garden in January, you say? Well,
Well, that's when you
they'll tell
start
you what to do.
peppers,
Rot and Roll, which is a hands-on adventure in composting. I like that title. Rot and Roll. And then finally, they have planting, trimming, and painting bare root trees for backyard orchard culture. So
Painting them. That sounds like fun. Let's have an art project in the backyard. That's January 10th, by the way. You said January 1. January 10 will be the mini
January
talks.
20th.
These
All
are
right.
at the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center, which is, I have the address down here, 11.
11549 Fair Oaks Boulevard. So,
They have a water-efficient landscape garden out there, which is open all the time, 7 days a week from sunrise till sunset. You can walk through anytime. The food growing part is closed off, but is open to the public when they hold events there. And they now have events scheduled January, February, March, April, May, June. August is the big harvest day, so they skip July, August 1. Mark your calendar now for Saturday, August 1, Harvest Day. Big event out there. Lots of horticulture leaders in the region will be there, and then September and October. So their schedule is online at ucanr.edu, Sacramento County Master Gardeners.
so, Don, I have one of the most spectacular emails we have ever received. Really, seriously. This is Jonas, and he has been working on redoing his front lawn into something much more extravagant than a lawn. And
Extravagant.
he writes, "Hello. In response to a recent conversation on the show about UC Verde buffalo grass, I wanted to share my journey converting my lawn a couple of years ago. I love the show and all that you teach. Here's a link to the accompanying photo album hosted, and he gives a link. So, Don, can we put that link in the description on the KDRT website when we archive this?
Actually, I'll
Oh,
put it
that was quick.
up for longer term. I'll put it on the davisgardenshow.com website. So,
Okay, we'll do both. We'll do
started in
both.
2022, decided to stop watering my existing lawn to make it easier to remove later. Well, I guess that would make
In June,
in
forget that.
June.
Is, get the months here because this is important.
And he's here
In
in the
June.
valley. Also, he's here in the valley. This is important to know. So,
Yeah, because.
2023, January, after about 6 months of not watering, removed the lawn with a sod cutter. I want to mention this part because people ask me about this, how well it works. Took a sod cutter is a machine that cuts out the turf exactly like the sod that you would buy in from a sod company. You can literally roll it right back up. And the idea was to take it and then just flip it over for you cut it out and flip it over so that the grass is now down, which is probably going to kill it, right? Placed it right back where it was in hopes that it would block the light from activating and also mulch out potential weeds. It sort of worked, but the grass, even upside down, started to root. So we ended up tossing out the grass little by little in green waste over the next several weeks. So for those of you thinking of this, because I've had this mentioned to me by landscapers, oh, I just cut it with a sod cutter and flip it over. Well, it sort of works. I think that's a good answer. And by the way, if there's Bermuda grass in there, it won't work. I mean, it really depends on what kind of grass you're dealing with, but it's pretty good. And I guess ultimately he then just took the time to pull out the remnants and get rid of them. Did a bunch
So,
of
Don,
plant.
let me,
Go
before you
ahead.
go further, I want to ask about this sod color because I'm seeing the picture and you're right, it's rolling up the sod, but it's, I mean, it's even on the bottom. Does the cutter actually cut? I can see it cuts the sides into a strip, but does it cut underneath as well?
Yes, that's exactly what it does. So this is the same machine they would use to harvest sod that you would buy. And it's
Oh.
basically you can take your lawn and sell it to someone else.
And this is rented. He rented the sod cutter. That's important.
It's a pretty big
And
machine.
it has.
One person can handle it, but it'd be better to have two for someone to help you with it. And it's
And
slow going, but it does a good job, especially if the soil is at the right moisture status.
he said that it took less than an hour to remove 500 square feet, and it cost about $100 for the rental. So that's pretty good for getting rid of a lawn.
This is why
I mean, it's
a lot
wow.
of landscape contractors will want to come in and use one of these to take away your lawn. It is one way to get rid of your lawn without using any pesticides or herbicides, without smothering or anything. You can just cut it out. I do need you to be aware that there are grasses that will resprout from little segments of the rhizome that might be left behind. Whether it's a desirable grass like the ryegrass bluegrass or an undesirable grass like Bermuda grass, they can resprout. This is not a perfect solution, but there is no perfect solution in this situation. This looks like it worked rather well.
And then he said in March 2023, he started planting trees and shrubs where I knew I was going to be making beds. And so he shows a picture of his planted that, and then around it he's put what would you call that? Fermark mulch
It
or
looks like some kind of fir bark compost
yeah,
mulch.
a thin, fine, not arborist wood chips, but more fine than that. But anyway, it's in a large area around this bush that he planted. Then in June of 2023, I converted the sprinkler system to drip line irrigation where I could and prepared the area where the grass would be planted. Cost around $200, but I was able to use local rebate reimbursed. Then I covered the entire area with weed barrier landscape fabric. When laying down a weed barrier like this, it's important to overlay the seams by at least 6 inches so no growth sneaks up through the gaps. Accounting for a little extra overlap, I spent about $150 on my project. It was well worth it. I didn't see a single weed or blade of grass afterwards, and there's pictures of that part. And then here we go, 2024. March of 2024, I ordered 500 plugs of UC Verde buffalo grass from the florist source for $450.
Yeah.
I wasn't able to plant them right away after they got in, so I had to keep them watered for a few weeks in the trays.
Yeah.
I would recommend planting them as soon as you can to prevent loss. I think I lost about 15 to 20 plugs that had withered due to lack of water.
Yeah, it's intended that you get these planted right away, and that's important. Although only losing 15 to 20 out of 500 isn't bad, honestly.
Yeah,
But yeah.
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 So April of 2024, I removed the landscape fabric
Wait,
and
very important to repeat that.
I removed the landscape fabric,
Yeah, so it was just
and
intended
it's
as a temporary cover to kill the weeds. It was not put in as a permanent thing, and that
well,
is
no.
important here.
If you look at the picture,
Yes.
he removed the landscape fabric where he was going to plant
Right,
grass,
that's
but he
correct.
left it underneath where he had laid out his stones for the walking path. So that's, I think, a key to making it easier to control.
Lower maintenance in the long run. Yeah. With
Yeah.
landscape fabric under flagstone, under paths is very common. Bear in mind that landscape fabric and DeWitt brand, which is what looks like you use here, the woven fabric, is very good quality. Heavy duty landscape fabric does work, but it slows down the penetration of water. So if you cover a large area with landscape fabric and we get a lot of rainfall, you're going to get runoff. If you have just under your paths and the nearby soil is open or has grass on it, then you aren't really creating a drainage problem. So he used the landscape fabric to smother weeds for a season, then pulled it out, left it where the path is going to be. You won't be able to plant between these flagstones. You're not going to be able to put anything in there because there's landscape fabric down under there. But things that creep in, like buffalo grass, will fill in around the flagstone anyway. They don't have to be planted into that spot. So it'll look fine. It's just going to be a little longer before you have things growing in around the stones.
But his design was to not have anything growing between the
Correct.
stones.
Yeah.
Okay, so April 2024, I planted the plugs at 9-inch intervals to help it fill in quicker. I laid the irrigation system in the area where the grass was being planted at 6 to 8 inches deep. So the irrigation is submerged.
Yeah.
Then in May, I ended up digging out the drip lines, which I had buried, and replaced it with a line designed for subsurface irrigation. The copper shielding at each drip node deters roots from growing into the line
Yeah,
and
that's
helps
important.
prevent the line from getting clogged.
Yep.
So that added a ton of work and another $100, but I think it was the right call as it's still flowing well 2 years
Yeah,
later.
many years
You want to
ago,
talk about that just
now.
burying plain or
Yeah,
getting something special?
many years ago, drip irrigation for turf was introduced, and the first problem was that the roots would penetrate the emitters. And all kinds of designs for emitters came out that would help supposedly to block that, but they weren't super effective. So his comment about the copper shielding at each drip node is to allow those drip emitters underground, under grass, to continue functioning. You don't need to worry about this in most situations with drip irrigation, but when you're irrigating a plant with an aggressive root system, such as any grass species, you may have problems with them actually reducing the output or just basically blocking the drippers over time. So that was an important, I think, a very important decision to make, even though it cost an extra number of hours and dollars. It probably made a big difference in the long-term success of this landscape.
Well, before we go on to his next part, I wanted to ask you, Netafim has been out for quite a while now. How often do you need to check whether those drip heads are actually working?
You can't. That's a problem.
You can't, you mean you can't see?
Yeah, they're underground. They're buried. So as we often say, very, very important aphorism at the Davis Garden Show, plant performance is your best indicator of whether your irrigation system is working correctly.
Oh, there you go again.
Yeah.
Okay, so then here we go. July 2024, and he sends a picture. The lawn had mostly filled in at this point. You'll notice some runners growing across the top of the grass at this stage. That seemed to have subsided now that the grass is thicker. I'll know for sure this year if that's how it is or not.
Yeah, they do. Buffalo grass is like a restrained version of Bermuda grass. I don't want people to get the wrong idea when I say that. It doesn't run all over your yard and become a major nuisance the way Bermuda grass does. But buffalo grass does run out slowly, steadily by rhizomes. And the rhizomes can creep into the border, creep in over the edging and into the nearby bed. More to the point, they run across the lawn. They run over themselves, and as you mow, that problem is essentially not visible. But you'll see it if when I'm looking at this picture, I can see what he's referring to. It's not a big concern, but it is something that does happen.
And it looks like the rhizomes, which are still connected to the original plant, are able to grow even though they can't root.
That's
Is
right.
that
They're
correct?
growing very happily between the stones and rooting,
Yeah.
and might even be rooting through the landscape fabric, very likely, in fact, in the long run.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So then we move on to September of 2024. Pretty happy with how well
Yeah.
it established in just 6 months.
Yeah.
And it's quite a lovely front yard. I mean, congratulations, Jonas. You did a
Yeah.
great
Yeah,
job.
6 months. That was the key thing we were looking for there. 6 months is roughly
Yeah.
what this took to fill in and make a nice solid turf. And I don't see any weeds in here because Bermuda, buffalo grass has sufficient density and has pretty aggressive roots. It tends to crowd out most weeds. The weeds that are likeliest to be a problem are things like oxalis, what the one that creeps along the ground. You've probably seen it. Not the yellow-flowered sour grass, but the little creeping oxalis, because it could fling its seeds in there. And if there's any open soil, it could root and grow in there, and you might need to deal with that. But for the most part, buffalo grass has sufficient density, even though it's a short grass, to shade out and outcompete most weeds. And that appears to be the case here.
And he's definitely mowing. It's
Yes.
looking
Yeah.
very, very nice. And then we have throughout the summer, my watering schedule is for about an hour, 2 to 3 times a week. I should be able to reduce that even further this year now that it's established. And
Buffalo
then
grass has been grown at as little as 20 to 30% of the irrigation of a conventional turf and looks fine. So you can gradually back off on your irrigation now that it's established and go to maybe once a week very thorough watering and see how it goes. And again, plant performance will be your best indicator as to whether your watering schedule is appropriate.
okay, and then he sends us a picture from March of 2025, and it's spring and the grass is just starting to come back. And he writes, UC Verde does go dormant in the winter. It'll turn brownish yellow, but I didn't think it was looking too bad. It added a little variety to the neighborhood when all my neighbors have cool season grasses
Yeah.
that thrive in winter.
Yeah, you
I'll
have
take
green
a hit
lawn. I
for
have a brown lawn.
I'll take a hit for a hardier grass. I'll never have to seed, could go no mow, and lower water costs.
Yeah, you
And
should. You should.
it doesn't, it's a greenish brownish mix.
It looks like
It's
Bermuda
not,
grass in this regard
yeah.
too. And there's in Davis, for example, El Macero is a golf course community southeast of town. A lot of the lawns there are Bermuda grass. If they're uniform Bermuda grass in the winter, they're just a tan brown color and they look fine. They're just not green. It's the ones that have weeds in them. So you've got brown with spots of green. Those look unsightly. So a lot of people will deal with that. But if this has a reasonable color most of the year and it goes brown in late December and it greens up in early March, that's a pretty short dormancy. And again, yeah, the trade-off is significantly lower water usage over time. And you don't really have to mow it. It does get those runner things you're talking about if you don't, but you don't have to mow it. It'll stay low. It doesn't get tall and clumpy as other grasses would do if you discontinued mowing. You could probably mow just a few times a year if you wanted to and keep it looking very good. And the lower water cost is the main reason people go to buffalo grass. Aside from the disease resistance and the density, the fact that you can water significantly less than conventional turf.
And Jonas is in Roseville, so
Yeah,
that's
which is just,
near us, the same climate. And
yeah.
thank you so much, Jonas, for sending us this sequence of pictures telling us what you did. All right. So, Don, let's talk about blueberries.
Yes.
Before we get to blueberries, I wanted to Emily's question. She's on the central coast of California in the Fog Belt, and she says, what edible berries would grow well there? I'm thinking of trying raspberries, blackberries, strawberries, and blueberries. Any varieties you could recommend for low chill winters with high summer fog?
Let's
Would
look at.
any less common options like lingonberries, currants, or huckleberries possibly work too? I'm looking for things my kids would like to pick and eat. The lower maintenance, the better.
If I were going through that list for things kids like to pick and eat, blueberries would definitely be way up high on the list. Incredibly popular with kids. But you know what? That was quite a list. All of them. There are varieties that can be grown in coastal zones. Let's go ahead and start with blueberries, just so you all know if you haven't grown them. They're different from most of the other things that we're asked about. Most of the others are suckering perennial plants that send up shoots from the ground that grow up and climb onto something, and you tie them on and you cut them back after they're done. Blueberries are shrubs. They're totally different. Blueberries are basically like a rose bush. I've grown them and they vary from 3 to 6 feet depending on the variety. And they need light pruning at most, maybe a little renewal pruning after a few years. And they don't run all over your yard and root like crazy the way
And
the blackberry crowd does. And they don't
they
sucker.
do not have thorns, so they are nothing to
Correct. Yes.
feast on.
Now, not all blackberries have thorns either, so we could get to that in a moment. But
But
blueberries, of course.
blueberries are little lovely little bushes between knee high and shoulder high, depending upon the variety that you get. And they're so nice.
The
They're
thing I
so
would note is that there's been a whole lot of new varieties of blueberries that have come on the market just in the last 10 to 20 years. Actually, an interesting fact is that blueberry hybridization and selection barely even happened until the 20th century, which whereas raspberries, blackberries, they've been selecting and breeding them for, centuries before. Blueberries are a relatively new crop for home gardeners, lots of home garden varieties now, a relatively new crop for farmers in the United States, simply because in the past they were too soft and delicate to ship to market. So they were just a very local or regional phenomenon. Now there are blueberries that you can grow just about anywhere. And the most important question asked by someone on the coast is the chilling hours issue. Old-fashioned blueberries from the upper northwest or upper, well, northwest, sure, upper Midwest and the northeastern United States typically needed 700 or 800 hours of chilling dormancy to go properly into and out of dormancy and produce fruit. Those are the northern high bush or the northern low bush blueberries. There were always blueberries for the southeastern U.S., rabbit eye blueberries, they were called, but there were always fairly limited number of varieties available. There are a whole lot of new southern high bush, so lower chill, warmer tolerant blueberries that have come on the market. And now there are interspecific hybrids between the northern and the southern, which have the great flavor quality of the northern blueberries, but the greater heat and low chilling tolerance of the southern blueberries. In fact, if you're in a low chill area, Biloxi variety, Biloxi, is described as needing zero chilling.
zero. Wait a minute.
Zero.
Zero chill. So
Yeah.
if it needs no chilling and it's from Biloxi, does that mean that it's a evergreen perennial?
Pretty much. Now, this is actually an interesting thing to note. Many of these blueberry plants don't go properly deciduous here in California. We sell 10 or 12 different varieties of blueberries over the course of any growing season. I've got several growers doing them. Some of my coastal growers, if I brought them in right now, they'd be in bloom. They'd be blooming already. They might fruit as early as March, depending on whether they get pollinated. Really, that's the only question in December, January, if they're blooming, is whether there's pollinators out there for them.
Or paintbrushes.
Well, it's an interesting flower. You'd have to get to know the structure pretty well.
Yeah.
Side note, bumblebees are better pollinators for blueberries than honeybees, actually. Interesting fact. The Xylocopa bee that we get here, the carpenter bee, is probably better than honeybees. They have an unusual flower structure. But that was Biloxi. And the other one that is just proving to be very adaptable, very low chilling requirement, if any, is one called Sunshine Blue. And it's actually a compact bush. It's a tight grower. It's got very showy flowers. They describe it as evergreen. Okay, well, that's a matter of definition, but yeah, in warmer climates, my guess is it never goes fully deciduous. Tolerant of high pH soil is a comment that has been attached to Sunshine Blue variety for as long as I can remember. Just very adaptable, and it grows almost anywhere. It's widely grown, apparently, in Southern California. So those are two you could look for, but I wouldn't be too concerned about any southern high bush getting enough chilling on the coastal parts of California. So if the label says southern high bush, and that includes Misty and O'Neill and Jewel and a bunch of others, very high likelihood that it will grow and fruit for you, even in areas that are very low chill. It's the blueberries from the north that you're not going to do real well with. And they are actually the main reason most people didn't think we could grow blueberries out in California and warmer and arid parts of the West. It's important to note, Blueberries come from places where there's a nice supply of leaf litter going on the ground every fall, where there's a steady supply of organic material coming down on and around them. They have very even moisture in most of the places where they grow well, and we don't have those things here naturally. So you need to provide them. You need to mulch them. You need to water them efficiently and effectively. In my experience, that means micro sprayers, not drippers, because their roots are very fine. When I've dug them out of a container, the roots break apart, fall apart. There's very few big woody roots. It's mostly quite a network of smaller roots. And if those dry out, the plant will stress very badly. So keep it mulched, use micro sprayers. That works real well. If you do drippers, make sure you have enough density of distribution of the drippers. That is to say, every 8 to 12 inches maximum to get the coverage that you need with the watering. And I was watering mine when I did them in livestock troughs twice a week, and I got great results. But I use micro sprayers rather than drippers.
So, Don, do you have to have more than one variety in order for the cross-pollination?
Good question. No, but it helps. So this is an interesting phenomenon. What they found was, for many, many years, they'd recommend putting bee boxes out where they're doing commercial production of blueberries, even though honeybees aren't very efficient at pollinating them. If you put enough boxes out there, they would do it. And finally, I love it when research professors do this, take their graduate students and make them count and weigh things. What they found was same number of berries, but bigger. So when you got cross-pollination, you got more pounds. Because the bigger the berries were bigger, not more fruit, more pounds. So yeah, it was worth it. And main point was they went through this whole thing and did a whole economic analysis. It was worth paying for the bees to come in and have a couple of varieties and get cross-pollination. So you need pollinizer and pollinator to increase yield for farming. You don't need that. You'll be fine. You'll be happy with what you get from one plant. But I've had lots of people who read about cross-pollination just take the simple expedient of putting a couple of them together in one planter. Two in a barrel will last for 4 to 5 years. Two or three in a livestock trough should go on for 7 to 10 years. And then they'll start to crowd each other out, and you'd have to do some, replenishment, maybe prune them and perhaps replenish the soil. But you can put them close together, and it does apparently increase fruit size. So that's the main issue. More pounds.
So blackberries, raspberries, strawberries.
Yes, strawberries are.
Blackberries and raspberries are canes,
Yes.
but the strawberries are
Totally different. Yeah.
little things with runners.
Little ground cover things. Let's talk about blackberries and raspberries. You are lucky enough to live in a place where raspberries are easy to grow. I'm going to say this real quick.
Wait a minute, you're not talking to me at
No,
that
not
point.
you. I'm talking to
I'm
the
talking to Emily.
Emily. Yes, you're very.
Okay.
I would love to grow raspberries. I have tried all the
Yeah.
varieties available to me. I've planted them. I've watered them. I've done them in sun. I've done them in shade. I've fed them. I've not fed them. I've done everything. The plants grow great. The plants spread freely. The plants flower, and the fruit doesn't develop properly. And the
So if you
reason.
need raspberry leaves for tea,
Yeah.
you're, but if you want to actually eat something,
Yeah,
forget it.
I go out and pick one here and one there, and it's just extremely just unsatisfactory in the interior, has been my experience. Every now and then I'll hear someone say, "Oh, I get loads of raspberries," and I want to say, could you verify that? One, that they're actually raspberries, two, which variety they were, because that would be really useful information. Invariably, they are heavily feeding them lots of organic material and watering them like crazy. So that would be a good starting point. When I tried them in light shade, they grew really well and they flowered great. And I thought, okay, we're finally on to something. What invariably happens here is as the fruit is expanding, we get up into the 80s or even low 90s and simply doesn't develop properly. So it's basically too hot here in the Sacramento Valley, in my opinion, to grow raspberries. I don't want to sell them to people and have them think they're going to get really good results. But you know where raspberries are grown in California? In the coastal
Coast.
zones.
Yeah.
So Watsonville, for example, has lots of raspberry production. I do want to mention, and this is frustrating, the same spotted wing Drosophila fruit
Oh.
fly that gets onto cherries and has caused me to say, don't plant cherry trees. It came into California, originally was found on raspberries, red raspberries in the Watsonville area. So it's very attracted to red fruit. So be aware of that. It means that you will probably need to cover your raspberry patch with a lance with frost blanket or row cover seedling blanket as they're coming into production to prevent the fruit fly from ovipositing on the red raspberries, or look for some of the different colored ones. We do know Spotted winged Drosophila is very attracted to red fruit. When they first showed up on cherries, they go to Bing and Lapins and the other classic red cherries, and people who had Royal Anne, which is a pale pink, almost white one, found those weren't badly affected, infested until later in the season. But at least they could get them by the initial infestation. And so we think the same thing probably holds for raspberries. Red ones would be least preferred for you as a gardener because of the risk of spotted winged Drosophila, but you could try the yellow ones or the black ones, or just be prepared. As I say, when they're in bloom, and the fruit is starting to set, take seedling blanket, frost blanket is what it's usually sold as, and just put that over the bed very securely, and you can actually literally keep the fruit flies from ovipositing on the fruit. So I want you to be aware of that so you don't go to a lot of trouble to plant red raspberries and then find them full of worms 2 to 3 years from now.
So those don't attack blackberries.
Well, they can. This is the thing to know about the spotted winged Drosophila. The host range is any soft fruit. In Japan, where it's native, it even attacks persimmons. But it has an upper temperature range. So we know that the temperature range of this particular fruit fly is about 55 to 80, 85 degrees. Above 80 to 85 degrees, the males become sterile and the population basically dies out. So it attacks anything that ripens before about mid to late May or June here, which includes
here in Davis.
Here in Davis in the Central Valley, which includes cherries. They're grown in California for the early market. We know that it attacks the red ones preferentially over a paler one, so that's something to keep in mind. But it can attack even peaches or nectarines if they were ripening early enough. People have occasionally had problems with it on blackberries and boysenberries. But usually, my assumption is that's because there's a cherry tree nearby that's got massive infestation that is going on to nearby berries because of the cherry tree. I know that in cherry growing regions, part of the management of spotted winged Drosophila is to get rid of all the berries because they can harbor the pest. So on blackberries, it's less of a problem, not as likely to be a problem. If you're really deeply concerned about this, pick them, put them in a bowl, fill it with water, and see what happens. If there's any spotted winged Drosophila larvae in there, they'll float to the surface right away. More commonly, we don't have a problem with it on blackberries, even in the coastal zones, but it is something to be aware of if you have a high population pressure due to an unmanaged cherry tree or a big field of raspberries or something nearby. So just be aware of that possibility. I don't want to dissuade you from growing caneberries. They're very easy to grow. Probably the most popular cane berries in California are boysenberries. That's our classic California berry. It's the berry from Knott's Berry Farm in Southern California. It does extremely well. All the other varieties are fine, but something to keep in mind in the coastal areas is you don't get the heat that makes them sweet. Isn't that clever? You don't get enough sun input in many cases to get really rich flavored blackberries, but boysenberries, we expect to be tangy. That's their flavor profile. So people in coastal zones tend to be very happy with blackberry, boysenberries, and the other one is the olali berry, O-L-A-L-L-I-E, which is a blackberry type, but it's a little on the tangier end of the spectrum. The boysenberry and the olali berry are a little higher acidity, therefore a little tangier flavor, and that's the California preference. If you grew up in the Midwest, you want a sweet, soft, black blackberry, there are varieties that do that, but not for the coastal zones. They're better for interior areas. Strawberries are really easy to grow. And of course, the main strawberry producing companies in California are on the coast because that climate allows them to plant, harvest, kill, plant again, harvest, kill. Repeated annual cropping of strawberries is the agricultural approach. Very different than what you're likely to do as a home gardener. There are lots of great varieties of strawberries, and I think any of them will do about equally well for you there. Albion, Sequoia is one of my favorites for flavor, amazingly rich flavor. Eversweet is very good. Quinault is a popular one for one interesting reason. It's a very good flavor. It actually sends out runners, which put out fruit on the runners before they even root. So it's really popular as a home garden variety. It's good quality, medium-sized fruit, nice flavor. And you can put it like in a hanging basket and the runners will go down over the side of the hanging basket and fruit. There was a big marketing push for this like 20 years ago. They'd send out pictures of hanging basket strawberries with like 15 fruit hanging on them. It does actually work up to a point. Thing to know with strawberries is each plant typically lasts maybe 2 years. The first year is great. Second year tends to decline. Third year, they're usually dying out. They send out runners. So they make a ground cover, just like the ornamental strawberry that you sometimes see. The runners will root and make a new plant for next year. We really do recommend, because of the number of disease and pest problems that just start to increase on strawberries shortly after you plant them and begin to really take their toll by the second or third year, that you take some of those runners and put them in a different part of the garden and sort of move your planting around. I had a customer who was not particularly a gardener, but his daughter loved strawberries when she was a little kid. So anytime he came into my nursery, he would buy a couple strawberry plants, whether I was selling them bare root or in containers or in six packs. And he'd take them home and go, where should I plant these? And I said, you know what? Just stick them in almost anywhere. Sun is best. Light shade is okay. Water is best. He stuck one in a pot with a cactus. He stuck one in a barrel with a lemon tree. Stuck two in the ground. What he found was that a few weeks after planting, they would flower and fruit almost no matter what. So pretty much any time she went out there, except late summer, pretty much any time in the spring and early summer, and even again, sometimes in the fall, she could find a strawberry to pick. That plant might only last a year or two, but he'd stuck another one over there. So it was actually a great, really easy gardening project for someone who was fundamentally not a gardener. So if you read about strawberries, you'll think, oh, these are complicated. They're one of the highest input, highest sprayed crops. There's a lot that goes into producing strawberries for the commercial market. For home gardener, they'll flower right in the pot. Frequently, when you're buying them at the nursery, they'll be fruiting right away. One of the few things I can promise you is going to fruit almost immediately after you plant it. Will fruit again the second year, and typically at that point, that individual plant is getting woody and starts to die out. Simple technique I learned years ago: if you have an open bed of strawberries, is about 1st of February, take a leaf rake and just gently rake through the bed. You're pulling out the dead leaves. You're also pulling out the older crowns that are beginning to get old, die. And so you're just basically rejuvenating the bed really effectively by raking out the old stuff that's carrying diseases over the winter, carrying mites over the winter. And you're just kind of cleaning up the bed that way. And that'll get you a second year out of one planting. There are places where strawberries do continue for 3, 4, 5 years, but typically for a home gardener, they're about a 2-year plant, but they propagate themselves. So it's the easiest thing in the world to take those runners and just take them, root them somewhere else, dig them up if they've already rooted, move them somewhere else. Just get them away from the existing bed to move away from the increasing disease and pest problems that you're already developing. Just keep planting them as a perennial crop. Yeah, go buy more. It's one of the cheapest things nurseries sell, honestly. So it's the kind of thing where you can just go out and plant new ones late winter, again in pots in the late spring. In the fall, some nurseries have them, and you can get fruit off and on from the day neutral types over many, many, many weeks of harvest.
And because at home, when you grow a new plant from a runner, it's the same variety. It's the same plant. It's not seeded.
Correct.
So it's not a hybrid. It's just whatever it was in the
ground.
Well,
it's a hybrid,
it's the same as the plant you planted.
Correct. It's a clone of the plant you planted. So you're getting a new plant that way. There are some that are grown from seed. I occasionally get people wanting organic strawberry plants. Very, very difficult to get organic strawberry plants. But there's one way to do it. From seed. And there are some seed grown varieties that you can find. If you're looking in your seed catalogs, as we all are right now, you will find seed strains of strawberries. And I do have a couple growers that do them. So you can buy individual plants that have been organically grown, certified organic. There's another whole group that's grown from seed. And they are really cool strawberries, but they're very different. The Alpine strawberries, which are miniature. Their fruit is maybe 3/4 of an inch, and it's bright red, or there's some that are pale pink or white, and you pop it in your mouth and you wonder, wow, this doesn't have any, oh my God, is the usual reaction. Powerful flavor, real aromatic, somewhat tart. Typically, Alpine strawberries taste like wild strawberries. They're very easy to grow. In the valley, I recommend them for shade because they just fry if they're in full sun, whereas your regular strawberries are fine in full sun. If you've got a shade garden and you want a food plant, there aren't that many to choose. Well, this is one that's a good possibility. I grew Alpine strawberries in a barrel for over a decade until the barrel fell apart. And actually, you could walk by this planting almost any time of year and pick a handful of little strawberries from it. Even in the middle of the summer, they would continue to fruit. And they also, if you don't happen to pick all the fruit, they will reseed themselves where they are in the barrel or nearby. So they tend to naturalize. Totally different. It's a different species of Fragaria, which is the genus of strawberries. Easy to grow, plenty of water, partial shade, and even a fair bit, surprisingly full shade. They did very well for me. So those are Alpine strawberries. Coastal listeners do very well with red strawberries. I hate to say this, They're also a host for the spotted wing Drosophila. So people growing strawberries in the coastal zones will sometimes start to cover their beds with the seedling blanket or frost blanket to prevent ovipositing on the fruit. Don't want you to freak out, but you might find some worms in your red strawberries.
So we've been talking about berries, and there is a question that came in that Don sent me. It says, any idea what this sweet batch trademark blueberry variety is? It's a Driscoll's brand. They were, I think, bringing in something from the grocery store.
Yeah, they sent a picture, and it was Sweetest Batch is the brand on the plastic box that you're buying the fruit in. Unusually large fruit. They looked very nice. Driscoll is one of the biggest producers of berries of all kinds in California, and in fact, internationally. They have operations all over the world. So he wanted to know, what is this variety? It's like when people ask me, what is the Cuties Mandarin? It's not actually a variety. It's a marketing program. And this is the important thing to know about this, because the next question, of course, is, can I get this? These were really good. Can I get this variety? And the simple answer to that is no, you cannot. Driscoll has about 30 patents on named varieties of blueberries. They name them Driz Blue 25, Driz Blue 26. They're just giving them their own kind of code names. And I was able to find the patent descriptions of most of them. And they appear to be, they've had the breeding program going at Driscoll's now for, looks like, at least a decade. And they're looking at fruit size and low chilling requirement, because Driscoll wants to be able to grow blueberries at their different licensed growers' properties all over the world to be able to provide you with blueberry fruit basically year round in the grocery store, and they can do so. So that low chilling requirement enables them to partner with farmers in warmer climates. For example, the large fruit size has definitely got consumer appeal, and they want a little bit tougher skin so they hold well. I mean, there's certain characteristics they're looking for. The bottom line, Sweetest Batch is a trademark name, just like Cuties is a trademark name for mandarins. It's likely that the berries being sold in that plastic box are not always the same variety. It could be any of those 25 or 30 patented varieties that they have in production. They have growers in different countries, including Latin America, so they can provide fruit year round. So very likely propagation is prohibited. Very likely, we know the plants are patented, so you can't casually go out and get it. And it's very likely limited to their licensed growers. It's a marketing program for different varieties that have similar characteristics suited to different production regions, ripening over a long enough period for market purposes. Very similar to the Cuties marketing program for mandarins. That one uses three different varieties of mandarins in order to harvest over a 5 to 6 month period. And when that ends, they go down to their growers in the Southern Hemisphere, and they are able to provide 6 months of production. So it's a marketing program. Nope, you won't be able to find Sweetest Batch blueberry at any nursery.
Well, Don, it's December. You're not doing anything in the garden, are you?
Oh yeah, I am.
What are
Yes,
you doing?
planting Iceland poppies again, because the last ones I planted got dug up by a squirrel. So now I'm going to plant them and cover them with a cage until they get established. I have a whole flat of snapdragons to plant when it's not too muddy out there to go out and plant them. And I'll be doing some pruning. I've got some roses that I'm going to prune back a little hard this year because they've gotten sort of rangy and out of control. It's a good time to start doing that. Good time to start pruning your fruit trees if you want, mostly done in January, February. You can certainly start now. But here's, I'm going to flip this around. You sent me a few weeks ago a flower of the month thing. I don't remember where it
Oh,
was from a magazine or something.
yeah,
Some,
I don't
yeah.
remember.
Okay. So, what I like is that the December flower of the month is paper white narcissus. Now,
You would like that, wouldn't you?
I
You
do.
like those flowers.
I love them. I love them out in the garden. The reason I think this is relevant, if it were me, I would have made cyclamen the flower of the month for December. But pretty good chance that some of you have received paper whites, either growing or as bulbs, maybe even flowering already. They might be in a pot. You might have gotten a little vase that you fill with rocks and put water in. Paper white narcissus are very, very easy and popular because they'll bloom almost no matter what. They'll bloom just rooting into water in gravel if you have a big enough container. They'll bloom in a 4-inch or quart size pot in regular potting soil. So the question I often get is, then what? Well, this depends on where you're listening. If you're in USDA zone 10 or 9, sunset zones 8, 9, or 14 to 24, it's done blooming. You can just stick it out in the garden. Just put it in the
You can
ground.
If you're me, you can give it to Don.
You can do that, sure. This is, let's back up here. What is a paper white narcissus? They smell wonderfully sweet and sort of musky, and not everyone likes the fragrance, but there's a lot of variation in that regard. So this is an important thing to know. Paper white is one of those common names that we use for a particular variety or two or three or four of Tazeta hybrid narcissus. It's a group of subtropical origin narcissus. They come from warmer climates. So those of you listening in USDA zones 8 or lower, I'm pretty sure 8 is the threshold for these. They can't grow them out in the garden. They'll freeze. They're not hardy enough to grow out in the garden. If you're looking in bulb catalogs, you'll see them in the back of the catalog under, along with the freesias and the other subtropical species. Here, we can just stick them in the garden, which is a great place for them, and they'll multiply very freely, I can assure you. One plant will be a dozen plants in just a few years. They'll flower, some as early as October, some November, a lot of them in December. And we call all of those paper whites, or the yellow version, Soleil d'Or, or there's one that's white with a yellow center. These are all Tazeta hybrid narcissus. And they're all too tender to grow in colder climates, but they grow very, very readily in California, just about anywhere in California, at least at the lower elevations, out in your garden. And they're blooming out. I've got a bunch of them in bloom out in the in places where I planted them more than 30 years ago. Yeah, you can cut them and bring them in the house if you like, but more pleasant is to just smell them out there and then walk on. You can enjoy the fragrance and then take it or leave it as you prefer. Over the years, less fragrant paper whites have come on the market. So I have paper whites that were given to me from in the 1980s from a woman who planted them originally in the 1940s. And I have these old, what are they, 80, 90-year-old paper white narcissus in my yard, and they're an ivory white color, and the petals are more twisted, they're tall and kind of gawky, and they're powerfully fragrant. When we first opened about 1980, brighter white, less twisty petaled, and slightly less fragrant, but still rather powerfully fragrant paper whites had come on the market. They became the very popular ones. Over the last 20 to 30 years, two other varieties have come on the market that are even brighter white, shorter stature, even more perfect looking flowers, and very lightly scented. So there are less fragrant paper whites and more fragrant paper whites. Problem is, you don't know which ones you're buying, but if you happen to get the less fragrant ones and you don't happen to like the fragrance, well, great, good for you. You can plant those out in the garden and enjoy them. All of them do very well here. Tazeta hybrids are a California specialty. They flourish in our area and multiply quite freely. So if you were given one of these for Christmas, you can let it bloom indoors or out on your patio or out by the front door. It'll be fine in any of those settings. When it's done, probably your best bet is simply to put it in the ground, whether it was rooted into gravel or growing in a pot, whatever. However you forced it is the term we use. However you forced it to bloom indoors, you can then plant it outside with no problem. We can do that here with paper white narcissus. So enjoy the bloom in the midwinter and then put them out in the garden someplace. Little sloppy, floppy looking plants. So stick them down on one end of the border and they'll increase very happily.
So the other thing sometimes that Don does is he'll send me a picture of something blooming in his garden, and he just sent me this luscious, beautiful,
Luscious, there's a good
bright,
name, yeah.
brilliant crimson red salvia in
Yes.
the middle of winter.
This
It's
is
pretty.
this plant has really astonished me since I got it from a little grower over in Santa Rosa. If you're in that area, it's Amarisa Gardens is the grower. They do a lot of interesting perennials in 4-inch pots. That's been their specialty for as long as we've been ordering from them. This one is, I'll give you the name, Salvia gesneriflora. Mole poblano. Okay, so the gesneriflora part is a
Sure.
cool one. It means flora, flower, like a gesneriad. It has a flower that resembles members of what I would call the African violet family, except that African violets are the least typical in that family. They sort of look like a gloxinia flower. They're fuzzy flowers and they have a distinct calyx that's much darker color. And these are the classic salvia tubular flower. And the mole poblano, I'm not sure what that's all about, but this is a bright, I would describe it as scarlet or cherry red, take your pick. And the plant grows 6 feet plus tall over the course of the summer, and you wonder if this thing is ever going to bloom. And then along about October, it finally starts initiating flower buds, and you think, oh wow, it's going to flower and then freeze. Nope. Our climate, and I'm talking about out in the country, it's perfectly cold hardy. This has gone down to temperatures in the mid 20s in bloom for me last January and came through just fine. And it starts blooming essentially November to December and continues all the way till almost May. So it's a winter blooming and spring blooming, but winter blooming salvia. And you might think it's going to be frozen back, at least in our climate, it is proving to be perfectly cold hardy. Yeah, tough one to find, but jot it down and ask your local nursery if they happen to order from Emerisa Gardens over in Santa Rosa, or figure out a way to get one yourself online. Salvia, Gisnera flora, Mole poblano. Hummingbirds get very excited about this plant because it's blooming December, January, February with bright red tubular salvia flowers. I have lots of salvias, but I could just leave the sentence right there. But I have lots of salvias that continue to bloom into the winter. They were blooming in the summer and fall, the autumn sages, the Salvia greggii, Microphylla group, all those hybrids. There's blooms on a few of them sort of still out there. This is just starting its bloom now. And so this is one that is kind of off cycle with all the other salvias that you can grow, and it gives this amazing bloom. I know it's hardy in USDA zone 10 and 9B, and I'm in 9A, and it's hardy here, so we're fine with it. I don't think you're going to go much colder than that. Let me pull out my trusty Western Garden book and see if they even mention this particular
It
species.
might be too new.
It is very likely. Yep, not even in there. Okay, so we know that it goes down to the mid-20s, at least from our own experience. It's a big, lush, sort of tropical-looking plant. You're not just going to put this in a casual part of your border. It's going to get 6 by 6 with no problem and bloom, as I say, sprawling outward and blooming all winter long. So give it a little space and you'll enjoy bright red, fire engine red flowers right through the wintertime.
Well, we have a question here. Our listener in Roseville has said, "Hello, I planted a young blood orange early summer of 2023. I've attached a few photos of it over time and where it is today. I have pruned some branches, but only a few heading cuts to promote lateral growth, which I'm not sure it helped much with. A healthy tree all around. I've counted 8 oranges this year. Hopefully, these photos provide a good example of an overgrown citrus. The first photo attached is from March of 24. The rest are from this week."
Someone
And
asked on a in a local Facebook group when you prune citrus, and my answer was I prune my citrus after frost is date, any danger of frost has passed. So I typically am pruning them March, April. And then the next question was, what are your pruning goals? And that's really the key question. Why would you be pruning a citrus? The primary reason for pruning citrus for home gardeners is control the size of the tree. But if you do nothing, most citrus, oranges for sure, grapefruits, the bigger leafed types, and as a good generalization, get 12 to 15 feet plus, and in some cases as much as 20 feet. And so pruning is mainly so you'll be able to reach the fruit, or you may not want a tree that big. Sometimes we do it to get them up off the ground to get better air circulation under the tree. That's to minimize citrus brown rot, which is an occasional disease problem on them here in the valley. So there are some varieties, navel oranges, Valencia orange, some of the blood oranges, well, all the ones I can think of, grapefruit, pumelo, those all get big if you let them. Even on a so-called semi-dwarf rootstock, they're going to get 15 feet plus. Lemons, Eureka lemon, Lisbon lemon, 20 to 25 feet, giving you 2 to 3,000 lemons in a particular season. And they're thorny. Lemons are often pruned for size control and just literally to reduce fruit production. And the other pruning you need to do is to watch carefully and remove any suckers that come up from below the graft union, which can happen at any time of year, mainly up for air circulation, down for size control, sometimes reduce the size of the plant just for fruit load reduction.
when I have my mic on.
There you go.
We always close with a quote. And this time, the gardener says, that's the name of the book, the gardener says, "Gardens are the story of two things, culture and biology. Gardeners are the storytellers."
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.